It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
Well, in this week in history, we're heading back to 1519 and to Spain, where on the 10th of August that year, a Portuguese sailor named Ferdinand Magellan bade farewell to his wife and family in the Spanish city of Seville and headed to sea. He's gone down in history as the first person to circumnavigate the globe. But did you know that he never made it back from Spain? Magellan actually died on a beach in the Philippines after backing the wrong side in a tribal battle that he'd got himself involved in. His voyage is celebrated, but our guest tonight is going to tell us that you should be more inclined to view it as a failure. Felipe Fernandez Amnesto is the author of a new book called Straits, Beyond the Myth of Magellan, which has just been published on the 500th anniversary of the conclusion of Magellan's voyage in 1522. And Philippe is with me. Hello, Philippe.
Hello, Indira. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Nightlife. Now, this is exciting. I always love it when we explode a few myths. So tell us about Magellan and his early life in Portugal.
Yes, I'm very sorry to miss the item about the sports bra. That sounded
I know. Well, you know, you can keep listening to us on the ABC Listen app, Philippe, after we've done your chat together, so you can hear more about the bra.
Yes, that's an irresistible invitation. Yes, of course, your intro is quite right. Not only did he not complete a circumnavigation of the world, he never even contemplated it. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that he ever intended to circumnavigate the world. Indeed, if he had intended to do so, that would have been A, literally impossible, because his whole plan depended on being able to reach the goal that the Spanish crown really sought in this period, which was the so-called Spice Islands, those islands in what we now call the Moluccas, where cloves and nutmeg and mace were available, and uniquely available. And these were, per unit of bulk, the most valuable products in the world. And he couldn't possibly, you know, have got back via a circumnavigation of the world. His plan was to, obviously, to return by the route that he went out on, because his whole conception was based on the relative proximity and navigability of the route from Spain to the Moluccas. So he absolutely didn't contemplate a circumnavigation of the world. But I think in order really, you know, to understand why he's such a subject of fascination for us today, one's got to realize that amongst dead white male explorers, which is just about the worst thing you can be nowadays.
It is.
He was one of the worst. You know, morally, he was a traitor, an arsonist, a murderer, a masochist, and yet, you know, his reputation has survived, whilst that of other relative good guys like, you know, Columbus.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not
been,
after.
You know, just besmirched by detractors. So that's what's really interesting about him. It's the durability of his reputation as a great man of science, and which he absolutely wasn't, as a you know, model explorer, which he absolutely wasn't, and as a good guy, which he absolutely and emphatically wasn't. Why has his reputation survived whilst that of, you know, other dead white male explorers has collapsed?
Yes. Well, you've rackled me now. I'm very annoyed that his reputation has survived. But I think your book your discussions are going to go some way to prick that bubble. Okay, well, let's go back then to where the myth began to be created, Philippe. So tell us about Magellan and his early life in Portugal.
Well, I don't think his early life in Portugal contributed very much to the myth. I mean, he was pretty much a failure from the word go. He was an orphan. His parents died when he was young. He was fobbed off on another branch of the family, who sent him to the court of the King of Portugal for his education, where he was, you know, treated really like a poor relation. He was a marginal figure, virtually a kind of outcast. And it built up in him this terrible, you know, kind of resentment. Perfectly understandable in a way, because I think those of us who feel cheated of our destiny when we're young often do become the victims of our own brooding and our own hatred of the rest of the world. And I think that was really the dominant feature in Magellan's upbringing, and maybe that contributed to his reputation indirectly, because it kind of drove him. In his early reading, when his boyhood and his youth, he read what we would now call sort of adventure stories, romances of chivalry, which were like the, I don't know, the station bookstore, the airport bookstore pulp fiction of the day. And he came to see himself as the hero of one of these romances. And that's the trajectory, that's the story that he tried to realize in his own life. And maybe that accounts, you know, for why his reputation has endured. It was a function, in a way, perhaps, of the extent to which he was driven. But I think the real reason, the main reason why he forged this great reputation in his lifetime, is that he had a stooge to write his story up for him. And that's what we all need. It's some, you know, publicist, really good publicist, who'll write our story up very favourably. And Magellan was lucky enough to get that.
Oh, right. Okay, Philippe. So he spent some time in service to the Portuguese viceroy to the Indies, didn't he? So he got to know the Indian Ocean well. What were some of the more important events he took part in during those years?
Well, he was a witness, really, of the birth of the Portuguese Empire in the Indian Ocean. And he took part in a lot of the early conflicts along the Malabar coast, along the western coast of India, and up and down the east coast of Africa. And during that time, though he didn't particularly distinguish himself in battle, he did get to know kind of alluring facts about what lay beyond the reach of the Portuguese further east in the Spice Islands. And I think critically in the Philippines, that's where his ambitions came to be focused. He learned a little bit about the Philippines when he was living in Malacca, which was one of the Portuguese conquests at the foot of the Malay Peninsula in 1511. And there he learned about the riches of the Philippines, the fact that these islands had gold, that they were very close to China, which was a place that all Europeans wanted to trade with, because that was the world's leading economy of the day. It's heading back to being the leading economy of the future. It was absolutely the number one place of economic advantage in the early 16th century. That's where everybody wanted to go. That's where everybody wanted to trade with. So the fact that the Philippines had gold, that they were close to China, really riveted Magellan's attention whilst he was serving the crown in the Indian Ocean. And I think that dominated his ambitions for the rest of his life.
So he wanted to explore further the Spice Islands and these routes around them, but the Portuguese didn't want to back his explorations, Philippe. Why was that?
Well, I don't think he had really formulated that plan by the time he left Portugal. The reason he left Portugal was really not to do, I don't think, I mean, at least I argue this in the book, I don't think it was to do with the crown's failure to back his rather mad plans. I think it was resentment at his not getting the rewards that he felt were his due. You know, I've mentioned that he grew up with these feelings of bitter resentment. He's an orphan, he's an outcast, he's the victim of snobbery. He's inspired by these tales of adventure and romance. And he really wants to break out into the acceptance world and become a, you know, great lord and have this sort of knightly chivalric career. Indeed, you know, if you were a young boy in the Portuguese court working your way through the system in those days, the ambition was to become a knight. And the Portuguese crown never knighted him. When he went to Spain, he got his knighthood, and he got the opportunity to serve the crown in an enterprise which I don't think honestly originated in his mind, this enterprise of discovering a short route via the West around the Americas or through the Americas, a short route to the Moluccas. That was the opportunity that service in Spain gave him. But I don't think that was particularly his project. I think he was still focused on the Philippines. I mean, he did what the King of Spain told him, because that was the best route to advancement in the service of the Spanish monarchy. And again, I don't think that the reason he left Portugal was that the Portuguese wouldn't back this idea. It was that they wouldn't evaluate him on his own evaluation.
All right, so he's knighted, he's moved to Spain, he's moved to Seville. Tell us about the fleet then that he puts together before he sets off.
Complete disaster. Complete disaster, because obviously it was all the planning was predicated on the idea that the globe of the world is much smaller than it really is. In this respect, Magellan followed Columbus's lead. Columbus also imagined a world very much smaller, probably 20 to 25% smaller than it really is. We don't know exactly how big Magellan thought the world was, but he clearly thought it was a lot smaller than it is in reality. And therefore, that if he got around the Americas or through the Americas in some way, he'd only have a short way further to go, because nobody knew about the Pacific Ocean or how vast it was. Of course, when he eventually crossed it, he was very shocked to discover that it was hugely bigger than he had ever suspected. So that was the basis on which the voyage was predicated. And therefore, of course, the fleet was completely inadequate. I mean, they didn't have enough supplies, they didn't have the right kinds of ships, and above all, they didn't have the right crew and officers, because the way the fleet was constructed was really on the basis of sort of factional squabbling at the Spanish court. And Magellan ended up with a bunch of subordinate officers, all of whom hated him and all of whom he hated. And from the very moment that they weighed anchor, a sort of power struggle began on board the ships. And that's why, you know, the whole voyage exploded in bloody mutinies and reprisals, from which Magellan emerged victorious, but with, you know, most of his leading superior officers dead, in most cases, because he'd condemned them to death himself.
You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidu for our This Week in History. We're exposing some of the myths around Portuguese sailor Ferdinand Magellan. And with me is Felipe Fernandez Armesto, who is an author of Straits Beyond the Myth of Magellan. All right, things are really falling apart very, very quickly in Magellan's fleet. There's mass mutinies. So who's in charge then at this stage, Philippe?
Oh, Magellan, I think, always retains the reins of command. The way I see it, the way I argue it in the book, is that, you know, traditionally it's been seen as a struggle between Portuguese people in the expedition, Magellan, his members of his entourage and family, his hand-picked kind of supernumeraries on the one hand, and Spaniards on the other. But I think it was a much more subtle conflict than that. I think it had a lot more to do with class than it had to do with nationality. And Magellan, although, you know, I think he was a horrible man, did obviously have some very positive qualities. All of us are mixtures of virtues and vices. And although in Magellan's case the vices outweighed the virtues, amongst the virtues was this amazing capacity he had for connecting with people. He had a sort of charisma. And the ordinary seaman loved him and supported him against the, you know, snobbish leading officers who mutinied against him. So he was able to retain control. I mean, it was a very close-run thing, and the whole course of the mutiny was a series of crises which might have gone one way or the other. But Magellan, I think largely by retaining the loyalty of most of the ordinary crewmen, managed to overcome his enemies, put most of them to death. Couldn't put all of them to death because there wouldn't have been enough people left, to man the ships. But he put a lot of them to death, and from then on, he ruled the fleet with a pretty much an iron hand. And after that, there was no opportunity for mutiny. There was opportunity for desertion, and a lot of guys continued to desert, which is one of the reasons why, of course, everything went wrong in the remainder of the voyage, because it was not only was it undersupplied with inadequate ships, but also had inadequate
crew.
Number of men.
And all of this happened before Magellan found what are now called the Straits of Magellan, Philippe. Tell us about how hard it was to find a passage through the Pacific for Magellan.
Well, of course, before getting through the Pacific, you had to get through the Straits. And, the Straits are like this sort of terrible wind tunnel with the wind against you. And it was a very strenuous and taxing job just to get to the other end of the straits, and indeed it provoked a lot more desertions along the way. When he eventually gets out into the Pacific, after a few days, they encounter a following wind. And this is an amazing thing, because so far, everything on the voyage had gone wrong. And when they get a following wind, they get this sudden surge of optimism, this feeling that maybe God really now is on their side, and that the wind behind them that is blowing them towards their destination is a sign of divine favor. And those few crew members who've left as sources definitely kind of reflect this sudden surge of optimism. And the irony was, but the worst thing that could happen to them was to have a following wind, because it just blew them on and on across this unremitting ocean. They spent 90-odd days sailing across the Pacific with no choice but to continue with the wind that was blowing them ever further into the unknown and into progressive disaster, because, of course, the longer that stage of the voyage continued, the hungrier and thirstier they got, until, by the time they finally sighted a landfall they could make at Guam, they were literally trying to assuage their hunger by chewing with, kind of scurvy, rotted jaws on the leather linings of the masts. So they were absolutely at the last extremity of despair, and all of them very close to death. Many of them had already died and been flung overboard. And the survivors were very close to death by the time they completed the passage of the Pacific.
And Philippe, this is what is so incredible for us to imagine now, but Magellan had thought it would only take him 4 days to cross the Pacific, and he really wasn't, as you explained, prepared for the 4 months that it would take him.
Yes, I think one's got to ascribe this to two things. The main thing is obviously wishful thinking. Now, this voyage was predicated on a small world, and therefore, he would never have been undertaken if people hadn't thought it was at least possible the world is really much smaller than it is. Well, the second thing you've got to take into account is that there were some earlier claims that the scientific evidence supported this theory of a small world. Columbus had united a whole bunch of, theoretical arguments, none of which really held logical water, but which, people were desperate to believe in, because if you really want something to happen, you believe the falsehoods on which it's predicated. I mean, we've all seen this, in political life. I'm sure you see that in Australia just as much as we do in the United States or in Britain or in the European Union. People want to believe in the falsehoods that support their theories. And the second thing I think that, you have to bear in mind to understand this is that Magellan had access to a text which dated from about 5 years before his voyage, which was a purported account of an earlier voyage in search of a strait, which actually claimed to have discovered one and to have said that it was only 600 miles from the end of the strait to Malacca. Obviously, that was a false claim, and if indeed he had access to it, as I think he did, it clearly misled him.
Philippe, you mentioned that Magellan landed in Guam. It was in March 1521. And then he went on to the Philippines, which is where Magellan met his end. So take us through what happened.
Yes, he. It's very interesting that he went to the Philippines bypassing, he went to Guam and then the Philippines bypassing the Moluccas. So I think that's very strong evidence that he wasn't personally very interested in the Moluccas. What he wanted was to create a fief for himself in the Philippines, to get his hand on some of that gold and on some of that trade with China. But when he got there, he realized, I think very cleverly, I think he not only was he a very charismatic guy, he was also, you know, in many ways a very shrewd and sagacious politician. And he realized that the islands were very divided and that there was an opportunity here to impose political unity on them by backing one of the contending rajas, as they were called, one of the contending kinglets whose polities divided the Philippine islands. So he decided he'd back one of them against the rest and control the whole of the Philippines through a puppet ruler. And I think that was quite a good strategy in theory. That could have worked. The trouble was he backed the wrong guy. He backed a relatively weak king against a relative Raja, against a relatively strong one. And that's what led him into his final adventure, this campaign against the intransigent, recalcitrant Raja, the ruler of the island of Mactan, in battle against whom he met his death. And I think maybe, you know, the crowning tragedy of this terrible story is that he did it deliberately, that he, by that stage, he knew that his task had failed, that his prospects were hopeless. He wasn't going to get to the Moluccas. He wasn't going to fulfill his own personal ambitions. If he'd gone back to Spain, he'd have had his head chopped off because, you know, he'd been guilty of disobeying the king's orders and betraying the crown. So all that was really left for him was a hero's death. And I think he deliberately contrived that by going into battle, you know, with a very small force against a very large one in circumstances which made it, you know, rationally impossible for him to succeed. And, you know, his men retreated and he dies virtually alone, surrounded by a handful of devotees, fighting this last great battle and absolutely refusing to summon help. So I think that was a, you know, deliberate gesture. It was a sort of great career move to die heroically when he'd failed in life.
That is one interpretation of that. Philippe Fernandez.
Well, you sound skeptical, Indra.
Well,
I think I do actually produce an enormous amount of evidence in the book to support this argument.
I'm not doubting that that's what happened, but in terms of, you know, it sounds like, you know, it was the ultimate PR feat by him that he had achieved.
It was, absolutely. And also, you notice, you know, based on a fictional model of life, if you start believing, you know, the romances you read, you know, the heroic death does become more important than the unsuccessful life. And I think that's the terrible fallacy which led to Magellan's death.
Philippe Fernandez Amesto is with me, author of Straits Beyond the Myth of Magellan. All right, so what happens to the remaining ship? Does it manage to get back to Spain?
No. No, the two ships that remain, one attempts to go back to Spain via the original plan, you know, turning back across the Pacific, and that's hopeless, you know, that That mission in itself, you know, is a tremendous sort of epic saga. It would great, make a great movie, but it ends in disaster, and the few survivors make it back to the Moluccas, where they're captured by the Portuguese, and then you know, undergo terrible years of suffering. And of all the crew of that penultimate vessel, only four men ultimately survive.
Gosh.
The final, you know, the last remaining vessel, the Victoria, the famous Victoria, which is, you know, always hailed as the ship that completed the circumnavigation of the world, does make it back to Spain. But it only does that by disobeying royal orders and crossing back to Spain via the Indian Ocean. And as a result, you know, they're always dodging, you know, sort of Portuguese capture, and eventually 34 of the men are captured by the Portuguese. Most of the rest die on this terrible, harrowing voyage. And eventually, 18 survivors out of, you know, an original complement of something like,
Philippe, are you still with me? I think we may have lost him. Philippe Fernandez Armesto, author of Straits Beyond the Myth of Magellan. That's what we're talking about on This Week in History, about really what Philippe is sharing with us, quite a disaster, really, right from the beginning. Philippe?
Hello? Of the complement of the voyage, if you count, you know, those who didn't desert or mutiny along the way, 90% are wiped out in the course of the voyage. 18 get back home.
So, what was the reaction then back in Spain and Portugal to this voyage?
Well, the Portuguese weren't too worried, because basically this voyage had shown that a Spanish route, a Western route to the Spice Islands, was non-viable. And indeed, although most of the studies of Magellan's voyage have claimed that, in spite of all of this, the voyage made a nominal profit because the spices that they took back to Spain were sufficient to cover the cost, that isn't actually true. If you compute all the costs, the voyage made a very substantial loss. And again, I mean, the figure's rather boring, but I do get into this in the book and explain why. Even, you know, on the crudest financial calculations, the voyage was a failure. Nonetheless, you know, people always get the triumph of hope over experience. And Spain did send, you know, a few more voyages out in that direction, but none of them, of course, succeeded. They all ended in disasters comparable to that of Magellan's own. In fact, most of them pretty much worse, because nobody else ever got back to Spain from any of these voyages. So, you know, in every respect, it was a disaster. It didn't make money. It cost a lot of life and investment. It exacerbated war against Portugal. It led to the destruction of many indigenous people and communities along the way. And it didn't even have any significant scientific results, because people went on believing in the small Pacific, even though Magellan's voyage had actually demonstrated how vast and intimidatingly vast it was. And if you look at the maps that were made in the wake of Magellan's voyage, they all show the Pacific very much smaller than it was. He didn't even illuminate people's knowledge of what the world's really like.
Philippe, you've mounted a very, very convincing argument about what a disaster this entire voyage was, what a disaster Magellan was. So why then has the myth of this great circumnavigator survived all this time?
Ah, well, you had that great point, Indra. That is the whole point, that myths do not depend on the truth. In fact, they're usually the opposite of the truth. And people believe in myths because there's any evidence. They believe in the myths because they serve, you know, some present purpose. And obviously, you know, the myth of Magellan is all bound up with a myth of scientific progress, the myth of these great white explorers, the myth of Spanish and Portuguese contributions to the history of the world, which were very impressive and very formidable, you know, but Magellan's voyage isn't And you know, I think above all, if you look at the ways in which, you know, Magellan's reputation has been overvalued, it's very often, you know, in scientific circles, a lot of scientific prizes, a lot of university programs are named after him, as well as a lot of commercial ventures and so on. But I think it's in the realm of science that his importance has been grotesquely exaggerated, because we are so invested in the notion of scientific progress that we don't like to admit, you know, that sometimes it just doesn't deliver. And this was one of those occasions when a great, bold, adventurous experiment was a total failure. Now, I just think it would do us good probably to acknowledge the truth of that.
Well, I think you've gone quite a long way to starting that conversation. Philippe, thank you so much for that very engaging and entertaining look at Magellan's voyage and his background.
Well, very, very kind of you to take an interest. Thank you so much.
Philippe Fernandez-Amesto, who's author of Straits, Beyond the Myth of Magellan. And that was our very fascinating look at This Week in History.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.